Hello, everyone, and welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. My name is Giovanni Coco, and today I'm here with Professor Dave Patterson. Dave is a professor at St. Andrews University. He has published a lot of papers and is very interested in the coupling between physical and biological worlds. His work covers a range of scales, from individual, almost cell works, to the scale that I know, the one of biofilm and the interaction with sediment transport, and then to the even larger scale, looking at biodiversity and ecosystem functioning. I mentioned already his many papers. Also, I have to mention, and I will probably ask him to tell us more about it, he's leader of MASTS, a Marine Alliance for Science and Technology. Hello, David. Welcome to Coast to Cast, and thanks for taking the time to join us and answer some questions.
Thank you.
Let's get going, and let's immediately get into the questions. How did you start in coastal estuarine science?
Some people plan exactly how they think their life is going to go, and I was never able to do that. But as a child, my parents found that if they left me on a beach beside a rock pool, I would still be there hours later. And I think it was a sort of childhood fascination with the life in rock pools and on rock surfaces in intertidal systems that started that interest. But I don't really think I planned it in any kind of way. I was just interested in that kind of thing. So at school, I did quite well in biology and then got into university at the University of Glasgow to do botany. And most people think of botany as studying plants, but I spent most of my time studying algae, which are, of course, are rather simpler versions, but tend to live in fresh or marine waters. And so I spent my time working with those kinds of organisms and did reasonably well. So I was able to go for a PhD position. And I found one at the University of Bath looking at the non-target effects of herbicides that were washed into fresh waters and looking at the effects of those toxins on the life in the freshwater systems. And so it was kind of a progression. And then from that, looking at really algal populations in freshwaters, I got a position at Bristol University, which was moving more towards marine systems and working on the Severn estuary. And that work was looking at biofilms, which was thinking about the structure and function of biofilms and sediments. But there wasn't really much on their effect on the physics or the dynamics of the system. And that was where I became interested, because I was looking at the structure of those systems or biofilms under a technique that was quite new at the time, which was low temperature scanning electron microscopy. And that clearly revealed that these communities formed a kind of layer on the surface of sediments, and therefore the first thing that was eroded was not the sediment, but these biofilms. It wasn't planned, but I ended up working on biofilms on estuarine sediments and in one of the biggest estuaries around, the Severn estuary in Bristol.
And so after Bristol?
I was lucky at Bristol to get a Royal Society Research Fellowship, which kept me at Bristol for about 8 years. And then a job in Scotland, and I am Scottish, came up. And it was at the University of St. Andrews. And so at Bristol, I had a sort of research group, which was the Severn Estuary Research Group. But I was accepted for the lectureship at St. Andrews and changed that to the Sediment Ecology Research Group using the same initials. We're still working on biofilms and their effects on sediment dynamics, but also widening that, as you said, to looking at things like biodiversity and ecosystem surfaces, particularly on coastal systems. So I've actually been at St. Andrews for quite a few years now, over 30, in fact, and all of that time I've had the pleasure of working with students and staff on the dynamics of coastal systems.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more also about MASTS, this Marine Alliance?
Okay, that came about because Scotland has quite a lot of expertise in marine science, but it's spread around different institutes. So we never had this thing that, and I don't like the term, but people talk about critical mass as if science will be better if there's a big group of you all working together. In fact, there's some literature that challenges that, but just on a practical basis, we didn't have that in Scotland. So one way of cooperating was to provide a network that would bring people together to cooperate rather than compete. And so we were able to put in a submission to Scottish Government at the time, which was the Scottish Funding Council. And they supported that with about £18 million worth of funding to put together a network of marine scientists across Scotland, support PhD students in that area, and importantly, bring groups of scientists with the same cognate interests together to improve their chances of getting things like European funding or national funding with interdisciplinary projects trying to solve emerging problems. So MASTS was formed and funded for 5 years, starting from about 2009, and has now been in existence for over 12 years, and now is fully independent. The MASTS, as an organization, now has no government funding, but is funded by its partners and by the opportunities that it manages to attract to MASTS, things like what we call doctoral training programs, which is funding for PhD students, or by providing services to the community, and also by subscription from our members.
That's amazing. It must have been a lot of work to set this up.
Well, there's one of these things that if you do what you like, you don't work an hour in your life. I'm very lucky in that I enjoy what I do. It's hard to describe it as work. Of course, you can't include the marking and the writing lectures in that, which is definitely work. But running MASTS is a pleasure. And it's not just me, of course. There is a team that we've put together over the years, which works together to support MASTS. And also, you know, we have great contributions from the members who are in MASTS, the 18 sort of partners across Scotland. And now we've actually got one from England as well. So MASTS is still slowly growing and more people are becoming interested in joining.
As you know, here in this podcast, we don't only speak about science. We also want to know about you. So, for example, how do you balance your personal life and academic work?
Probably badly. I think when I was younger, I was worse. I used to work quite hard. Also had a young family. And I think that as a young scientist, you get into this habit of always trying to finish things and working to deadlines. And then people add extra work to that with teaching and administration. And so your life is pretty full. And in retrospect, I think I should have probably partitioned more time out to spend with family. And particularly when we had I met my wife at Bath University, and then we both lived in Bristol, and then we relocated to Scotland. And in that time, she had to change her career a couple of times, really, but also we had young children. So I can't sort of articulate how much that support was important to us as a family. And I think now I'm a slightly better at balancing the workload and the family. But of course, now the kids are growing up, so it's too late to do that kind of thing. And I wasn't an absentee father all of the time, but I certainly did spend quite a bit of time at work and probably should have spent more time at home. But there's a problem there. And the problem is that in academia, we're not only respondent to the organizational challenges, we're also being viewed in competition with our peers. And so writing papers, winning research grants, teaching at an excellent level, we're judged on all of those things. And so while there's maybe nobody specifically saying you have to do X and Y, we know that in order to get on with our careers, we have to be successful in these realms. So it's a really difficult balance to strike. But I think the times are changing and people are talking about well-being and balance much more than they used to. And I sincerely hope that younger staff aren't putting in ridiculous hours, but I suspect some of them probably are. So while I think things are moving in the right direction, I suspect that workload is still a challenge to a lot of people, and also specifically to women coming into science who are thinking of having families as well. And somehow that extra commitment, that's a challenge that is developing and hopefully can be resolved in the future.
What about your interests out of work?
Well, when I was younger, I played a lot of sport. So I think I used to sort of work hard, play hard. I think the sort of old term was. I was a rugby player. I played squash, tennis, anything with a ball, really, except football, because people used to fall over far too much. Later on, I actually broke a leg playing rugby, and it was quite bad, so I had to stop playing. So nowadays, I run, a member of a running club, which is a local running club, but also walking in the hills, particularly in Scotland, but walking holidays abroad as well. And that's with the family. And my wife is a keen runner and walker as well. So that's great. We can do that together. I like music, listening to it. I play some instruments, but it's kind of difficult to describe what I do as playing because, you know, it's all just from ear, not from reading music. And I just enjoy mucking around with a guitar, or I used to play clarinet a bit as well. Travel, of course. Very lucky, like you, Giovanni, we get to travel to different places and other people pay for it because we're working. And it's fantastic to be able to do that. But traveling with the family is great too. And reading. I like to read different types of material and listen to audiobooks as well, which is generally when I'm driving. I'd love to do more, but it's a question of timing. My daughter, for instance, climbs. And she took me to an indoor climbing arena and I had great fun there. So I'd love to fit in climbing if I could, not on the Matterhorn, but just on sort of easy beginner indoor climbing frames, which are great fun.
Let's go back to science. You work on a number of scales, on a variety of scales. You almost encompass all scales. What do you think about all those predictions that we make with numerical models, those long-term predictions of coastal change, of coastal morphodynamics? Do you think they make sense? Uncertainties are too large for predictions to make sense. Should we do them? Should we not?
Okay, I think we should probably do them. But I think that the real value of models is making us think about how systems work and then using the comparison with reality to adjust and improve the models. But however smart a model is, I don't think we are smart enough to put in all of the parameters that need to be addressed to make it fully accurate. I mean, we know that there are simple models that do work, but as you get into the environment and things like coastal morphodynamics, they become very complex in a short term. On a long term, when you include climate change, sea level rise, the properties of the coastline in terms of its facing erosion, and also what mankind has done to it in terms of building and moving things around, I think we have to treat models with extreme caution. And probably we have to think that we'll usually get them wrong, especially in the long term. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't do them because it helps us understand the system. But I would be skeptical in, for instance, flood defense planning. We've seen that breached so often. We know that our coastal protection and even some of the hard and soft engineering that we do is destroyed in storms we haven't predicted. So modeling is improving. The outcomes are extremely hard to validate. But it is something we should continue to improve. And it may be with the advent of artificial intelligence and with other methodologies that we'll get better at it. But I think we would be fooling ourselves to think we'll ever be perfect.
What about your favorite paper or a paper that affected your career?
Okay. I'd rather cite a book than a paper, if I may.
Yeah, you can.
Thank you. It was when I was doing my PhD, I started reading Stephen Vogel's Life in Moving Fluids, subtitle, The Physical Biology of Flow. I think first published in about 1983. And up till that time, I was kind of struggling with methodologies to think about how biofilms were affecting flow. And there wasn't anything out there that I could see that I could really use. I mean, flumes were well known, but they were very large. there weren't many that you could take out into the field. And so I tried to develop a new system that I sort of designed myself, which was called a cohesive strength meter, which was a much smaller system. But that was inspired in a sense by reading Vogel's work and seeing how chapter by chapter he went through how biology and flow and the physics and the biological dynamics work together. Everything from the feeding of rotifers to the way that plants positioned themselves in flow, that is water plants, and the way that even arteries and vessels in the human body worked, it was fascinating. And I thought, well, we should know more about sediment dynamics and the organisms that live in sediments and how they affect flow. And so Vogel's book helped set me in that way. And then I began to look for papers and then saw things like a thesis by Manzenrieder in 1983, which was looking at the Shields curve and why it was wrong. And then work by people like Dade et al. Looking at microbes and the effect of their exudates and erosion thresholds. That was really fundamental in sort of starting me off on that pathway.
So let's speak a little bit more. And please tell us the topic, a research topic you're working on.
Well, still working on biofilms. As you said, it's not just biofilms nowadays. It can be wider, but the most recent stuff we've been doing in the lab is looking at the effects of what we call multiple stressors. So we know that the environment is challenged in many ways. The popular one at the moment is plastics and microplastics. But, you know, there's still herbicides being washed into the system as I first started working on. And then we have everlasting chemicals and we have all sorts of pharmaceutical compounds. And we can look at how those chemicals affect different systems individually. But of course, that's not how it happens in nature. There's a kind of cocktail of chemicals that are released into the environment. And it's that cocktail that causes responses in the, you know, biological receivers. So we're looking at combining different stressors, that is these different pollutants or different chemicals, and seeing how microbial populations, particularly diatoms, behave in terms of those challenges. And the diatoms are interesting because you may know that diatoms are one of the sort of principal components of many intertidal sedimentary biofilms. They're eukaryotic single-celled organisms. They're capable of photosynthesis, so you can study how they photosynthesize, how chemicals affect that process. They're also capable of movement, so you can examine how locomotion is affected by different chemical stressors. And at the moment, we've just set up what we call diatom hotels, where we put a mixture of different species of diatoms into containers. And then in the laboratory, we challenge those communities against different levels of different populations. And I have a Chinese student working with us at the moment, Su Song Hu, who is helping us begin to establish some parameters of how these systems respond and change to particular combinations of chemical stressors. So that's what we're working on at the moment.
This is a cheeky question. Is it a little bit frustrating that still so many papers that describe estuarine morphodynamics do not account for biofilms?
Sure. And I think it's why multidisciplinary or transdisciplinary research is really important. And you're quite right, there are still papers out there that don't consider that. I think it's probably, you know, a learning process that, you know, in terms of modeling, it's a great example, because quite a lot of modelers want an erosion threshold, but they want one that is sort of spatially constant so that it can be a boundary condition to a model. But that's not how it works. And so modeling has to become more sophisticated in order to be able to take a range of probabilities rather than a specific threshold. And some people would even argue that a threshold per se doesn't really exist. It's more like a continuum of erosion, which is dependent on the force applied. And that's what I meant earlier when I said that, you know, the models have to be started and then have to become more complex as we understand more about the system. It can be a little bit frustrating, but you could look at it the other way around, that every so often I get approached by a different bunch of sedimentologists who have just rediscovered biology. And so it gives you new impetus to look at a different problem. And one recently was submerged gravity flows, where you have things like an earthquake or a tsunami, and there is a huge plume of sediment released underwater. And there's now some evidence that the sort of organic content of that sediment affects the way that these turbidity flows actually behave. So, you know, we're gaining ground that the organic content of sediments makes quite a difference to their behavior. So that's progressing. So I'm not sort of totally depressed about it, but I think the learning still needs to be translated across different academic boundaries, but I'm sure that works both ways.
I actually haven't met Dave until very recently. We just met in China, but I have met a couple of his PhD students. And so they were so happy about the supervision that I wanted to ask you to tell us about your approach to supervision of postgraduate students.
Well, I think students are human too. So I think they're not simply beasts of scientific burden that you put into the laboratory and flog to death until you get a paper out of them. I think it's really important to think of them as humans, to speak to them, to consider the work they want to do, to agree plans, to help them establish deadlines and a sort of timeline of results or achievements that is reasonable and possible. And I actually get sometimes a little bit frustrated with supervisors who want their students to work, you know, 8 in the morning till 8 at night, come in at weekends, etc. That's the old way. We weren't thinking about well-being and mental health in those days. There has to be a work-life balance. And, you know, a student, even if they come in at 9 to 5, they're probably doing reading in the evenings anyway, because eventually the PhD becomes their thing and they want to be successful. So then they begin to put in extra time because they want to be successful. But I don't think they should be challenged too early that, you know, oh, you must be working extra hours, you must be doing this, you must be doing that. They have to develop their own way of working. And really what the job of the supervisor is to discuss that, help them establish that, make sure they are progressing, and, you know, develop a sense of cooperation and mutual support in the laboratory, not just with that individual, so that the ethos of the laboratory is mutual support. For example, we do a lot of tidal work, as you'll recognize, and you can't go out on an intertidal mudflat on your own. You have to have somebody with you, just for health and safety reasons. So the students have to work together and they have to recognize that cooperation is important. And the same with, you know, things like analytical methodologies, learning R, thinking about the statistics, talking about that amongst themselves is all hugely important. And bringing the lab together so that it feels a supportive environment, particularly for new people. And one of the things we do is that we have a bell in the lab, you know, an old-fashioned ringing bell, and we ring it at 10:30 in the morning, and that's the signal for a coffee break for anyone who wants to take it. Unless I'm actually online, I always go, because I think bringing people together and talking about what they did at the weekend, and once you establish that kind of social dynamic, then work problems are easier to bring up and discuss when you're discussing them with somebody you know likes to ice skate or play hockey or walk up a hill or go wild swimming. It's all part of their humanity. And I think that's important to understand, even in a laboratory setting. So I think it's humanity and support so that, you know, you can develop the right kind of relationship to support the student in achieving their goals. The final thing is to say that a PhD is a training degree. A lot of students worry that it's not original enough or they haven't made a huge contribution to science. That's very difficult to do. And there are a lot of gaps that don't seem to be particularly original, but we need in order to fill in all of the gaps that are left in scientific advance. So I would also encourage students not to worry too much about being the next Einstein, but to do good science that answers questions, but is part of their training development so they can launch into a postdoc with, or whatever career they do decide to go into, with an excellent scientific training and understanding of the scientific process.
Let me ask you about machine learning. You mentioned earlier on that maybe it can help us to improve our predictions. Do you trust machine learning? Will you use it in your studies?
I like it. I don't trust it. The point about being knowledgeable in an area is that you can use AI, but that you can check it. And this is what we tell our students. I mean, AI is a tool. It's impossible to ignore that it's here. And why should we? I mean, we didn't ignore the wheel when it was invented. We didn't ignore medical procedures. We use them. AI is a tool. It's going to be a very important tool, and it's something we have to learn to live with. But I think it can also be misused. And so there is a need for some guidance and control and perhaps regulation so that we understand how we're using it and what it can be used for. But definitely sort of excited about the prospects that AI will bring to us. But I don't think it so far will replace knowledge and the innovation of humans. If it does do that, then I guess we'll all be out of a job.
Here is a strange question. Can you predict a major advance to happen in the next 10 years in your field of research or in coastal research in general?
Oh, I think I'd be better at predicting major decline than major advance. And I think bringing together the sciences more fully is probably where we're going to find solutions to problems, because the problems are becoming more and more complex. Things like multiple stressors. I think we're going to have to drive society with more information from science. And politics is dangerous in a way, because it tends to be short term, but the solutions to some of these problems are going to be long term. So I guess coming back to your modeling, if we have good models of what will happen in the future that can help us manage systems to help protect against things like sea level rise, which I think are going to be, you know, potentially catastrophic over the next century, then that would be the best advance, to bring those sciences together to deal with some of the really challenging problems of climate change that are emerging. And that could be things like carbon capture, which is essential. I don't see us meeting any of our targets. I think the COP process is good for talking about it, but in terms of regulating actual outcome, it's pretty poor. So I think there will have to be a technological solution to some of the climate problems that we have. And I hope the advances in the next 10 years will be helping address those problems.
Best or worst advice that you ever received?
I quite enjoyed this question. The best advice, well, one, multitasking is rubbish. You can't do two things at once. Work at a task for a set period of time or until it's finished, and set a timetable up to help you do that. There's no such thing as real multitasking. Don't panic. It's not life or death. It will probably be fine. That's probably the optimist in me. Seek advice and support from others. It's almost inevitable that somebody out there knows more about it than you do. So look for support, look for help. And finally, don't try and be clever, you know, especially in writing. You know, write in a way that's understandable. Try and make your ideas clear and accessible. I really don't like people who write to obfuscate or sound clever. So those are the best, probably.
Is there anything you would say to your former self?
I think actually I would have looked at my work-life balance a bit more, and also I would have looked for a mentor earlier. I think now mentorship, you know, seeking advice regularly from somebody who you admire or has achieved something, you know, that suggests they will be able to help you out in your career is very valuable. And I didn't do that. I did have mentors, but they weren't official mentors. They were just, you know, scientists like Frank Round and Dick Crawford that I really respected, and Colin Little, and they all helped me. But it was a more informal thing, and that might not have been bad. But nowadays, there's the opportunity to look for more formal mentorship. And I think that's quite a good idea.
Let's move to some final quick questions. Let's speak about music. Do you have a favorite band you want to point at, or music composer?
Oh, yeah, I've got this wild fantasy. I could have been in a rock band. Yeah, sure. I think you play guitar. Counting Crows, I like very much. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a classic rock person. I like things like Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, Uriah Heep, all of those things. You need to queue up outside venues all night to go and see some of those big bands. I've gone a bit mellow in my old age, I guess. I like some Scottish folk music now. I go to our local folk club regularly. And like country music as well. But so quite a mixture. I haven't listened to a lot of classical music, but I went through a strong jazz phase and still enjoyed jazz, particularly there was the Edinburgh Festival. We used to have a fantastic jazz festival, which I used to go along to as a youth. Yeah, and I do sort of occasionally try and play songs on guitar and clarinet still.
What about your favorite dish, or do you cook and have a signature dish?
I do cook. I enjoy cooking very much. I think Marie, my wife, would say the signature dish is a result of growing too many courgettes. And so you have to use these things. And so we now have a regular dish, which is a sort of Italian courgette with potato and tomato sauce covered in cheese and baked in the oven. And that's a sort of staple weekend dish during the summer. But we also have a thing called Patterson pasta. This wasn't me. This was my father. My father was a keen cook as well. And we both cook a lot. My wife and I share the cooking and quite enjoy both of us putting together meals. And Patterson pasta was a sort of adaptation of a bolognese using different pasta shells and slightly different flavoring, which my father took very seriously and used to spend hours in the kitchen cooking this sort of Scottish bolognese sauce with these rather huge pasta shells, and then with bacon and with some other ingredients, which made it slightly different from the classic bolognese, but still a family staple. So I guess those would be the signature dishes. The other signature dish I should mention probably is chili, because I grow my own chilies and I make chili quite regularly. So yes, enjoy something with a bit of spice in it.
So latest book you read?
I usually have two or three books on the go at once. I have a sort of routine in the morning. I've done this kind of restricted eating thing, so I don't generally eat breakfast, but instead of eating breakfast to sort of calm myself for the day, I have a coffee and read a book. But in the morning, I tend to read nonfiction. So sort of recent things, because of the war in Ukraine, I was reading the history of Ukraine. And then I went to Italy on holiday, to Sicily. And so I'm now reading the history of the mafia. For other kind of pleasure reading, I quite often read historic or science fiction novels. One I would recommend in terms of a sort of American and Mexican thing is American Dirt, which was a very powerful book to do with the drug cartels. And then in science fiction, I read The Three Body Problem, which is quite a fascinating book and certainly quite mind-blowing. And at the moment, I'm listening to Revelation Space, which is a science fiction sort of omnibus book. And that's the one I'm listening to driving to and from work on the Audible player.
Okay, very final question. Do you have a favorite movie?
I think probably it would have to be a movie and a book. The best book in the world is Catch 22. And the film I thought was going to be disappointing, but actually the film Catch 22 is different enough and done well enough that it's still a great film. So Catch 22 wins on a couple of points. The Deer Hunter is a great film. The Shawshank Redemption is a great film. And actually, I enjoy The Founder, which is to do with the beginning of the McDonald's chain. That was quite an interesting film as well, because it had such a historical backdrop.
Okay, I think we're about to get to the end of the interview. Is there anything else you want to tell our listeners?
I don't know. Science and scientific careers, it's a huge privilege. And I think that sort of being able to use your mind to think about problems in the environment and think about how to address challenges is just such a privilege. So that, you know, we should recognize that we're extremely lucky to be able to do that. And of course, there are other wonderful jobs out there as well. So science isn't the be all and end all. But I do feel extremely lucky I've been able to have a career like this where original thought can be put into practice. And that's something that is applauded, especially if you can make small advances. And just to say that you cannot do it on your own, you know, with me, it's my wife, Marie, but also the laboratory and also my daughters, Sarah and Emily, and, you know, the whole family aspect, which helps to support anyone to be successful. So it's maybe a bit rambling, but yeah, that's what I'd add.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's been a pleasure to meet you last month in China, and it's a pleasure to have you here on Coast to Cast. Thanks also listeners, and hope to see you soon, Dave.
Sure. Thank you very much for that, Giovanni. It was a real pleasure and unusual, as you say.
Bye, everyone.